Welcome to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. If you've ever marveled at how real a fake Louis Vuitton bag looks, you know the pressure to create really good copies, to fool our senses. But there's one business where the stakes for copies are higher than they are for scarves or smartphones. Pharmaceuticals. When a drug's patent expires, other companies are allowed to copy it. But the question of how long innovative ideas should be protected, especially when you're talking about life and death, is one that nobody seems to agree on. Jeremy Green is the author of Generic, The Unbranding of Modern Medicine. He's a professor at Johns Hopkins. Jeremy, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me here today.
So you're a professor of medicine. How did you get interested in generic drugs, which I'm sure are part of your life, but you know, how did it become a focus?
Sure. It's a fair question. I mean, I think when you look at even the word generic inspires almost a sort of boredom or deflection of interest almost immediately. How could, you know, a generic argument is one you've heard before, a generic product. You know, no one's ever going to win a Nobel Prize for inventing a generic drug, for reproducing a medicine that's been made before. Patents, as you know, grant the patent holder a monopoly to recoup investments made in developing a new product, especially in the field of medicines. But that monopoly is time limited. After that patent expires, the benefit of this new invention is shared with everyone in the population. But if you have a trademark, you can hold on to it forever.
Mickey Mouse.
Yeah.
Right.
Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. If I was to come up with a new soft drink and put it in a red and white can with a smoosh and call it Smoke a Smola, I'd be sued instantly.
Right.
So a lot of it is predicated on the concept that, you know, that can of Coca-Cola helps you know it's really Coke inside, but it doesn't define what it is to be cola.
I've actually got a really practical question for you about this, tying into your cola point. Everybody has been at CVS or at Rite Aid or wherever, and, you know, you're looking at the CVS brand and the name brand, and at least I always wonder, do I spend, like, a couple of extra bucks on the real Advil? I mean, what choice do you make in that situation?
See, that's a great question. I think Advil's a perfect example because ibuprofen is ibuprofen on the one hand. We could draw out the molecular structure of the active ingredient, ibuprofen. And in order to gain FDA approval for marketing, a generic version of ibuprofen needs to show that the molecule is the same, that it's present in the same quality and the same dosage and amount, that it's bioavailable, meaning not only that it's there in the pill, but that it'll reach the target site in the bloodstream at roughly the same rate as the original brand name compound.
So a company doesn't own ibuprofen, is that right?
Well, the company at one point did own ibuprofen back when
but
it was originally
anymore.
Marketed.
Okay.
But the original product patent on ibuprofen expired decades ago.
Okay.
And so now anybody can make ibuprofen, but in order to sell ibuprofen, they need to prove to the FDA that all of these standards of similarity are met. But one of the problems, and this is a problem I come to as both a physician and a historian, is that the question of what matters and how we know what aspects of a drug matter is not stable over time, and it's very dynamic and changes.
Yes, but if you were at CVS or at Rite Aid or at Walgreens or whatever, and you were looking at Advil and whatever that other bottle is called that says at the bottom in tiny letters, compare to Advil, and it's, you know, it's like $2 less, what one would you buy?
My own personal choice, and I've written a little bit about this, and I suffer from minor migraines. I love Advil. I don't mean to conflict. There's interest disclosures. I don't get any money from any manufacturers of Advil. I just love kind of its lenticular shape, its sort of smooth coating, that candy coating, that flavor that goes down.
Yeah, but that's not how well it deals with your migraine.
I want to argue that I believe that for my migraines, it actually helps me better. And I know it's totally experiential and probably a placebo effect.
So to really get down to it, you don't think that substantively there is that much of a difference between Advil and the CVS brand.
Exactly. I think trivially.
But you like Advil for migraines.
In an entirely trivial way,
okay,
which has to do with the fact that it's coated with sugar and it makes me feel better. And just like, you know, my migraines are controllable with a combination of ibuprofen and caffeine. And you can combine those in one pill and take it. But I find if I have a good cup of coffee and an Advil, I feel that I get better more quickly, personally. I don't think this is true on a populational level. I don't recommend this for my patients in the clinic. I think it's entirely anecdotal and experiential. Whereas if I was in a different aisle in CVS, and I also have allergies, I'm allergic to cats, and too many of my friends have cats for my own liking. And if I go to buy a non-sedating antihistamine, for example, I will always choose the generic version because I don't perceive any actual experiential difference in it. And in fact, the more serious the medications are. So, for example, when my son gets strep throat, which happens, you know, a few times a year, he's five.
Right.
When he gets strep throat, we'll get generic amoxicillin. And it's important to him what flavor it is. He likes the strawberry flavor better, but not the brand name. And if a patient of mine has pneumonia, I will prescribe a form of levofloxacin, for example, that will almost certainly be filled generically. So almost the more serious it is as an illness in my personal and clinical practice, the more likely I am to use generic medicines.
So a question for you about innovation, because, you know, you touched on this with Coca-Cola. If I came up with Mickey Mouse or Coca-Cola or I wrote Hamlet, nobody would say to me, well, you know, you can sell Hamlet for a few years, you know, under your name. And then after a few years, we're going to say, well, that was enough of you profiting from it. Let's take that innovation and make it available to everybody. So why do we do that with medicine?
You're getting at a number of questions at once here. One has to do with the way that we value innovation in healthcare as opposed to other worlds of innovative goods. And I think some good comparisons here are, say, computer electronics, right? There's also this added element of, well, why are medicines different from, say, electronics? And there's an article that came out just a few years ago in Nature Drug Discovery. And the authors of this study had one of their explanations of what they called the better than the Beatles problem. And to get back to your Hamlet question, right? So they imagine the scenario in which any new recording artist had to produce a song that was better than the Beatles, and the entire corpus of the Beatles' work was available free and online continuously. And they compared that to the problem of the existing supply of drugs. And when a new drug becomes old, it's still quite effective. And in some ways, many practitioners are more and more comfortable with older drugs because they've been around longer. You know, their safety risks better. And as drug innovation proceeds over time, a lot of the earlier discoveries were what we now think of as low-hanging fruit. And so it's harder and harder to find beneficial drugs that are as impactful as those that were developed in the 50s or 60s. So there's a challenge. And you can ask, well, why isn't the case with something like the iPhone? I mean, I have an iPhone 5, and I would not want to be using an iPhone 1 right now. Right, and so there's these generations of iPhones, which somehow this incremental use through planned obsolescence or other means, these newer products become more and more attractive. But the human body is not like the substrate of telecommunications, where, you know, 3G, 4G networks change and an old phone doesn't work as well. Presumably, old drugs work just as well in human bodies in 2000 as when they were first discovered in the 50s or 60s.
But how long do companies usually have to make money off of a given drug before a whole bunch of companies that make generic drugs then get a shot at that drug?
The data suggests that it's roughly 12 years. Okay. So that even though patent life is 20 years, there's a lot of time that passes between a patent and the actual FDA approval of a drug. So if you look at the average amount of time a drug is meaningfully on the market, a new drug, before there's generic competition, it's roughly 12 years.
Now, is that too long that one company has to say, I'm going to charge pretty much what I want to charge? Or is it not enough time because, heck, they put millions, maybe $1 billion into making the drug?
Yeah, so the answer to that question depends entirely on who you are.
Yes, but you are a doctor. I'm asking you.
So personally, I'm a doctor and I advocate for my patients, and I have a lot of patients who don't have insurance, who can't afford medicine. So I would say I'm more concerned because of my position with people who cannot access therapies that are known to work already than with those people that don't benefit from hypothetical drugs that do not yet exist, that aren't being developed because potentially the patent term isn't long enough. So I will always come down and say, I wish these drugs were cheaper and I wish my patients could get them. But that doesn't mean that anybody in the room would say that. Even a drug like insulin, which was one of the first miracle drugs of the 20th century in many ways, developed in 1921 in Toronto, patented in 1923, is not generically available in the U.S. market.
Wow.
In the year 2015. And so
now, how is that possible? You said it takes about 12 years for something to go off patent. 1923, my math is, but that was a while ago.
Yeah, and insulin is not alone. There's other drugs like albuterol, a staple for the treatment of asthma, or really a chronic disease of incredible important prevalence in the United States and disproportionately affecting poor people living in poverty, which was generically available in the 80s, is now only available as a brand name drug for much more money.
Okay, you've got this sticky situation with big important drugs doing battle with generics. How does that affect a medical practice like yours? I mean, do you find that even amongst poorer patients, there's a belief that a generic medication is a pale imitation of the original innovation, the name brand drug?
Certainly. And many people are concerned when they shift to generic drugs that they're not getting as good of a product. And the FDA is doing a lot of work to try and help reassure patients that the standards of proof are actually very high and very rigorous. But one of the things that a colleague of mine, Will Schrank at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, found out is looking, using zip code data and generic utilization, found this odd correlation where those zip codes most likely to see high generic utilization were precisely those with higher income and higher levels of education.
Which is the opposite of what you think. Wealthier people are saying, yeah, I'm fine with the generics, and poor people are taking the brand name drug?
Yes, and I've actually found in my own research active campaigns by the National Pharmaceutical Council, which was funded through a variety of brand name pharmaceutical firms, to partner with minority health groups, specifically to try and spread a sensibility, inculcate a sensibility that generic drugs might work in white middle class patients, but might work less well in Black, Latino, or Asian American patients,
wow,
and that minority groups should be particularly suspicious of generic drugs. And so there's so many different levels of irony at work in that process. But suffice to say, patients I see in my clinic are often skeptical of generic drugs. And when I work with a given patient on a generic drug, I try and show them exactly what I know and what the FDA knows about its equivalency data and why I would take that drug myself or give it to a family member, but then also try and remain attentive to how that patient actually does. Because fundamentally, as a physician, I have a responsibility to be an advocate for that individual. And if they're not doing as well on a new drug, then there's a need to try and recognize that and change them back.
Jeremy Green is the author of Generic, The Unbranding of Modern Medicine. He's an associate professor of medicine and the history of medicine at Johns Hopkins. Thanks for coming into the studio.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure to be with you today.